Welcome to Good Muslim, Bad Muslim, the ASMR Halloween spooky, wookie episode.
Spooky, episode. Hello, everybody.
Hello, our spooky listeners.
We have a spooky announcement.
Spooky.
Well, no, this is actually spooky.
Spooky.
Well, it's exciting for us.
It's exciting. It's good.
It's also
scary. It's very scary. Yeah.
A little sad.
Yes.
Are we both waiting for the other one to say?
I know. I don't want to say it. Oh, Good Muslim, Bad Muslim is coming to an end, y'all.
This is our fifth and final season.
We've been doing it for 5 years.
We'll be closing out January with a live show.
For folks in LA, please come through. Expect some really fun things in the next few episodes before January.
Everybody come through because we've got guests nationwide coming through.
Yeah, we're so excited for our January live show. We're basically celebrating our podcast. We decided that we didn't want to make this a sad ending. We wanted to celebrate our show and celebrate our amazing, you know, all the amazingness that we've done. Zara and I have more projects coming out after this podcast comes to an end. We both are planning on working on different podcast to come out. We're working on writing projects. We're working on shows. We have a very busy life. So you're not losing access to us. We're just gonna, you know, put the show to sleep.
To sleep. That's a little intense.
You know how like people say that they're gonna put dogs to sleep?
That's where my brain went. I don't know that we're
keeping... But when I was a kid, I was like, oh, is the dog's just actually going to go to sleep? And they're like, no, they're going to kill it. Then I was like, why would they call it going to sleep?
We're going to kill the show.
No, we're putting it to sleep.
It'll be around. If you guys want to listen to it, all 5 years of our monthly podcast, we never took a break, kept on chugging along monthly. And now, after 5 years, the two of us have, you know, discovered our individual voices. We have individual interests we're going to pursue.
Yeah.
So we're kind of excited.
We're very excited. We're excited to share these last few months with you because we have some really fun stuff up our sleeves. And we have fun stuff up our sleeves for this episode because we have an awesome guest joining us. We've been a huge fan of Aisha Siddiqui's since she released this amazing podcast with Amar Rahman like 4 or 5 years ago or something. And she has since come to LA, come to our land, and she's in our studio today.
Welcome, Aisha Siddiqui.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
For those of you new to the phenomenon that is Aisha Siddiqui, she is an LA-based writer and creative strategist specializing in trend forecasting.
And she has a dope-ass Twitter account, Aisha Siddiqui, at AYESHAASIDDIQI.
The A in the middle is everything, right?
Yeah. Which is, I think, how I started following you. And you can't see this because this is an audio show, but I am wearing an Aisha Siddiqui shirt.
Yeah, red merch that was also profiled in the New York Times.
I didn't know this was in the New York Times. I feel so special wearing this.
It looks great on you.
Thank you.
Glad you have it.
I'm so glad I have it too. For folks who can't see it, which is all of you, it says, "The ones we love are enemies of the state."
Yeah, that was a design I collaborated with Saba Mo'il, known as Cult Days, on. And so it's an original line drawing of her of an alicorn, which is the winged one-horn horse creature. And I knew I wanted to do something with an animal, and we arrived at that one because Saba's Persian, and the alicorn really appealed to her, and it appealed to me because this particular rendering is so powerful. It's a very powerful creature. It's carrying this heavy chain. And unicorns in Western myths are these very ethereal, delicate animals. Mm-hmm. And the way it's rendered here is more so a powerful beast.
And it has a tongue sticking out.
Yeah, this
it's ready for a fight.
Like kindergarten unicorn.
Exactly. It has muscle definition.
Mm-hmm.
It's breaking through its chains.
Exactly. And it's both winged and horned. And the phrase, "the ones we love are enemies of the state," is from Antigone, as translated by Seamus Heaney, and it was the epigraph to a recent novel by Camilla Shumsi called Home Fire. And it really appealed to me because so often the ones we love, the ones we ally ourselves with, those we want to stand next to are cast as enemies. And the state is very hostile to Muslims, to members of the LGBTQ community, to immigrants, to anyone
marginalized. Are they hostile?
Apparently
it's
so.
It's so true. Yeah, it is. It's and so true.
So I was very moved by that phrase because it affirms not only who's important to us, mm-hmm. but the shared position we occupy in society right now. And mm-hmm. I found it to be a very deliberate use of the word we, and it helped me be more mindful of who it is that's important to me right now. And taking care of my loved ones and being available to them is a more necessary commitment to me right now.
That's gorgeous.
Yeah. And I love this project that you're doing with Cult Days, because this isn't the only shirt you have with
her. Right.
You have a whole series, and all of it is just amazing. And you always drop them at like you don't know when you're going to drop them. And then all of a sudden there's like a new update on your Twitter. I'm like, oh, I want this one too.
Oh, that's very nice to hear. Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. It's cool to, you know, see something come to life, like an idea or a drawing I might have or she might have. That's how it originally started, was there was something I wanted to make for myself to wear.
Yeah.
But it was very cool to see that there were people who enjoyed it. And so it does feel like a way of building a small community of people with shared references. Uh-huh. And it's very cool to create those references. And it's, you know, just another medium of expression. I see the designs out sometimes, you know, or people send me when they spot them on the street. And that's always a lot of fun. Someone sent me actually a picture of them in the tank that you're wearing right now, the Ones We Love tank top. And they were at a prison abolition rally.
Yeah.
And actually ended up making friends with someone who was also wearing that design. And so they were able to connect because they found a sense of shared sentiment expressed in that. And so they became friends through that point of connection. Yeah. And then I really loved, you know, that they shared that with me.
When I used to frequent protests, I would always look for Muslimish shirts to wear. But you could have never buy them. I remember I spray painted my own t-shirt once just because there wasn't Muslim-ish fashion that existed. And now my closet is all full of brown designers and t-shirts. And it's so cool to speak on panels or go to protest or be out in an event and support people from your community in your clothing attire.
That's why I'm looking for halal socks to make grip socks.
I know.
Grip toe socks for my Pilates wear. I asked them for grip socks. They said they make them for toddlers.
Why? Toddlers don't do Pilates.
No, but they run around and fall on their face.
But I need... Did you really email them?
Yeah. Well, Instagram.
Oh, Instagram.
And they wrote me back. And they were like, oh, we should have those. And I was like, yes, I'm waiting.
We should get some good Muslim, bad Muslim...
Grip socks.
Grip socks. And have
for
them...
Pilates.
...available at our live show.
You do Pilates.
I do Pilates.
What kind do you like? Do you like the toe socks?
I haven't tried the toe socks, but... The socks are $12.
They're expensive.
They're so expensive. I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah. We need to make toe socks.
Rob Kardashian better watch out. Zara's coming here.
Here I come.
Your niche in the market.
You know, I was looking at the socks and really it just looks like someone got a glue stick and just kind of like pasted it on the bottom.
You could, right? Except I think glue hardens quite smooth, so it wouldn't provide the necessary grip.
Mm-hmm.
What you could do is you could glue something onto the socks.
Yeah.
That's grippy. Like, little pieces of rubber would provide traction.
Oh, hey.
I think we could do this.
We can make this happen.
So, Aisha, where can people buy your collab?
They can get it at theoneswelove.shop.
We're coming on our hot topics.
Yeah, let's talk about voting, because we had a really great conversation before we started recording about, I mean, I didn't mention this earlier, but I was also really disengaged from the electoral process after Trump got elected. So, I've been trying to figure out, which is really hard to say because this is kind of what I've put my career behind for the past 20 years, to get people out to vote and encourage people to turn out to vote. But also at the same time, there's this like element of disbelief in the electoral process. And I think it's been really complicated to hold both of these truths at the same time, like distrust, but also I need to go vote because I have to go vote. And you were saying something similarly.
We can't pretend that the system works.
Yeah.
We can't pretend that people in this country have a full and total right to vote, not with gerrymandering, not with voter suppression. We need to operate within the reality we have while also working towards the reality we need.
Yeah.
And that's a difficult thing to turn into a usable soundbite, right?
Absolutely.
Because it's complicated. People get discouraged, myself included, you know, because it's work. The things that have to be done require real labor and effort, and both of those compete with everything else people have to do in their lives.
So I still want to hear about like your experience of being outside of the United States for a little bit.
I started to spend more and more time outside the U.S., and I found that to be the distance to be quite clarifying and useful to me personally.
Ooh, clarifying how?
The perspective was so useful. So much of my life was determined by the U.S. and its politics mm-hmm. and my own emotional investment in something that was increasingly a toxic experience. Mm. I'm not an anxious person, but I was becoming quite anxious.
Yeah.
And I didn't like what it was doing to me. And I had to remind myself how big the world is and how many different lives are still possible within it. And it's the closest I've come to the way people talk about bad boyfriends or bad breakups feels akin to my experience of America, where I entered into something with a lot of love in my heart and with an openness that I was losing. And ultimately, it is my home. I became a citizen in 2015.
That was right before the Trump election cycle.
Mm-hmm. And I had the most despair around that time and finally becoming an official citizen of a country that was so committed to its lies about itself that it would allow massacres before it would allow an open recognition of what this country's central project is and how it fails its people. Spending time outside the U.S. helped ground me and helped me find some peace.
Yeah, some distance.
I was very aware of the luxury that the right to just up and leave a country and go to another because, you know, you're feeling kind of bad. That's such an extreme luxury.
It's also very diaspora.
I left and I came back because this is my home and it's where my family is. And I was living with a great deal of anxiety and fear over the violence that could be visited upon us. But look, we're Muslim. I'm Muslim. Violence can be visited upon you anywhere. Fear is not a useful emotion. And my time away helped me reconnect with that. And actually spending some time with my family where they live helped me reconnect with that. I moved back to LA this August. And I'm very encouraged by all the people in this country that are organizing and working to make it a more habitable one.
And speaking of family and where you were raised, I remember you telling me fond Halloween memories.
Oh, my first Halloween in America.
And this is the month of fear. So I'm really curious to hear, because you have really fond memories of Halloween. And
it's such a funny holiday. I mean, I always say you should live every day like it's Halloween, by which I mean I like to take long walks at night and eat candy.
Oh, that's a nice way to think about Halloween.
My very first Halloween, my family's first Halloween, was shortly after we'd moved to America.
What year is this?
1996. So we had no concept of it until one of our first nights in our little apartment that we'd just gotten into. We hear a knock on the door, and I was a little kid. I realize now in retrospect they're probably just teenagers. But to me, these very tall individuals dressed very aggressively like monsters.
Like monsters.
Faces painted.
Did you open the
door? Absurd costumes. My dad did, but everyone knew I was the real head of the household. So I was right there in case anything went down. Yeah. I was right there next to him, probably.
Wait,
coming
how
up.
Old were you?
Six.
Oh my God. 6 years old, head of the household.
That's just a joke. Right? I'm sure my sister would take issue at that characterization.
Did you have candy ready for these monsters?
Well, that's the thing. Of course not. We had no idea that there was anything expected
of
us.
Gosh.
So we answered the door. And both parties on either side of the doorway are confused.
Right.
They're waiting.
I just like this image of confused monsters staring at you.
Yeah,
like,
we're waiting. We're waiting. They're waiting.
Yeah.
Eventually, it's communicated to us, you're supposed to give us candy. And my dad's like, oh, okay. So he goes inside.
That's so funny.
And, you know, it was a house of two young kids. My little brother hadn't been born yet. Find some Crunch Bars.
Crunch Bars.
You, like, in the house? You found Crunch Bars in the house?
Well, we just got into America, and so, of course, my dad had some candy ready for us.
Oh, no. You had to give them your first American candy?
Oh, no.
So we give them the candy, and they're like, thank you. And
the full-size bars?
No, I think they're minis.
Oh.
Then they left, and, you know, we all learned something that day.
Did they? But
specifically, the exchange expected on Halloween. Now, here's the funny thing. It took years for my father in particular to embrace this concept because he loved to give out candy.
Oh, really?
The idea of his children going door to door begging.
Oh, no.
That's so funny. Deeply offensive to him.
That is so funny.
And every year we would excitedly explain, said, no, we can't wait. We're going to go and we're going to get sacks full of candy and we're going to get to walk around, you know, after hours. Because as a little kid, there's still a novelty to being out that late at night. And he was so offended at the concept. He was like, I just don't understand why you need to. I can get you candy. If you want candy, we can go right now. We can get as much candy as you want.
Not begging.
And he would. He would go out and buy a bunch of candy.
So
and he would get so frustrated that we still insisted on trick-or-treating. And one year, we put a pirate hat on him and took him with us. I think he better understood the appeal then.
Yeah.
You know, it was just a night walk with his kids. And
that's fun.
But still, he just was not a fan of the idea because it's feels so akin, you know, holding out your hand for anything from a stranger is a very offensive Pakistani sensibilities, which I understand entirely now. But
okay, I have to ask, what did you wear? Like the first time you went trick or treating, what was allowed?
Well, so most costumes in stores were like very cheaply made and not very attractive. Being Pakistani, what appeared to be an exotic costume to our white neighbors was our traditional Pakistani apparel. But our first year, my sister and I dressed as pirates, actually.
We
did store-bought costumes because that is where the pirate hat we eventually bequeathed to my father came from. And then the years after that, I mean, once we'd done that, we weren't as keen.
Yeah. So I feel like you got it a little easy with the store-bought. My parents did not want to spend money on Halloween. And we had the Desi clothes, but my mom just took the scarf and wrapped it around my head and called me a gypsy. So I kept getting variations of like taking Desi clothes and turning it into different things.
Or princess.
Indian princess. Mm-hmm. That was a thing.
So for any like school function requiring a Halloween costume.
That was it.
Here you go, something exotic.
Here's the thing about me though, is I loved my Pakistani clothes and I was very proud to be Pakistani and I didn't feel a way about doing that. I was like very pleased to show off the intricate embroidery or the fancy silks. And I thought like, you know, the very gauche polyester that my classmates wore I wasn't interested in that.
Of course not.
I think that's part of the difference in experience between someone who is born in this country to immigrant parents versus someone who immigrates to this country. I think you develop a different relationship to your culture, especially if you grew up in very white enclaves. And I and my sister also have a great deal of pride and very strong sense of self, like knew very clearly who we are and where we came from. So there wasn't as much motivation to quote unquote assimilate. So I'm already different. Like there's nothing I can buy at the mall that's going to change like the thickness of my eyebrows or the type of food I like to eat or who my parents are. So it wasn't a project that appealed to me in any way because I didn't see it as leading to a satisfying end. Like you could try as much as you want. You're never going to be white. And I frankly, why would you want to be? I'm good. Like to each their own. But eventually we all grew to love what most people love about Halloween, which is being out in brisk weather or eating lots of candy.
Or jack-o'-lanterns.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So candy.
Yeah.
When you say lots of candy, you mean
peanut butter cups, caramel apple pops.
Not candy corn.
I do like candy corn.
You do?
Boom,
There's going to be a lot of people listening to this who are going to react very poorly to the idea of someone enjoying candy corn. And in my defense,
which is me.
You're incorrect.
Zara gets it.
I do.
To me, I love the very strong butterscotch flavor.
Butterscotch or is it just sugar?
I really do just love sugar and I love the soft texture of it. And I think once you hear what other
waxy
foods
texture
are my favorite, you'll understand the appeal more.
Okay.
I love marzipan. I love cotton candy.
Yeah,
marzipan.
It's delicious, right? I want a house made of marzipan. I want to spend the rest of my years
candy bars of marzipan? I thought marzipan
You can buy chocolate coated bars of marzipan from Germany and you can get them at ethnic grocery stores in the US.
Oh.
You can also just buy a tube of marzipan.
I thought that was like to
I would
make
love
flowers.
To do that.
It's delicious.
And then you can eat the flowers.
Chomp into it.
You can sculpt it into anything you like and enjoy eating it.
Candy corn.
We might have to do this. Sorry.
Wait, candy corn was number three.
I love dark chocolate peanut butter cups.
Mm-hmm.
Honeycomb candy.
What is honeycomb?
Honeycomb candy.
Oh my goodness. It's delicious. So if you like toffee, You like the texture of honeycomb candy. It's aerated sugar. So it's made
by... I love by, aerated sugar, like cotton candy.
Like you heat the treacle, the golden syrup that it's made of, and you add sodium bicarbonate to it, and it foams up, and the foam quickly cools and hardens, and you break it up into pieces, and that's how you get honeycomb. It's often dipped in chocolate. It's also known as seafoam candy.
What?
Oh, you can get some at Trader Joe's.
Does not sound American.
Oh, it's delicious.
Trader Joe's
you
has
can get,
it?
You can also get it at my favorite ice cream place in Silver Lake called Magpies make their own honeycomb, and it's available as a topping on the most delicious vegan soft serve anyone will ever encounter in their lifetimes.
Well, clearly, we know what we're doing for Halloween now. Right?
I also love good old Haribo, but you know the made in Turkey ones because those are the ones that are halal.
Halal.
Oh, and Haribo.
Yes, Haribo gummies.
I didn't know they were halal in Turkey.
Yeah, so they're, I think any Muslim listening to this might recognize the impulse to flip the package of Haribo to the back and check the made in. And the ones made in Germany, not halal. The ones made in Turkey, halal.
I remember going trick-or-treating and always turning over the package looking to see if there was gelatin in everything.
I remember hoping my parents wouldn't do that, and they did.
Okay, Zari, what's on your list?
I want to hear yours first.
Mine are Pixie Sticks, Cherry Jolly Rancher.
What, cherry?
Yeah.
It's like cough syrup.
Mango, spicy lollipops, Whoppers, and Cadbury Flakes.
I didn't know Cadbury had flakes.
Yeah. No, so now what's yours?
Flake is the British candy bar. Mm-hmm. So flake has a texture similar to, well, not similar to anything, actually.
Yeah, it's just like flake.
Cadbury does a chocolate that if you ever travel to the UK, my mom loves flake. I don't think I can eat it. I'm allergic to dairy, but yeah. They're...
I never heard of it.
It'll fall apart.
Yeah. It's flaky.
It's, yeah.
All right. Here's my top five, which I believe should be everyone's top five.
No.
Number one, candy corn. Stop looking at me like that. Number two, wax lips. They're the best.
Is it sugar, though? I just thought that you just put it on your lips like
a toy. No, you chew it. They're delicious. It's like gum.
But you chew and you spit it out?
Yeah. You don't swallow the wax. It doesn't make any sense. Number three, caramel apple pops. They're really good.
They like are. The They're wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Number four, Kit Kat. I feel like it's solid. Like, no matter when, it's good. Number five, Nerds.
What flavor?
I would say any flavor.
I would say watermelon.
Oh.
I remember strawberry being good.
I just like the texture of them. And they're like a fun, funky candy. Mm-hmm. That's like these are the candies other than Kit Kats that you like only get during Halloween.
Yeah.
Right.
You know what I mean? I feel like
then
that's
you
the
stock
appeal.
Up.
Well, do you guys have siblings? Because there's an economy to Halloween. There's a post-Halloween candy stock exchange.
Oh, yes. What was your stock exchange?
So my sister loved Hershey bars and I loved peanut butter cups. Mm-hmm. So we would, you know, switch those. But she also loved peanut butter cups. So it would be a tricky exchange. Like I could get maybe one peanut butter cup for two Hershey's.
Oh, that's so civil. Zara and I are both the oldest sister.
Yeah.
So I feel like we probably did some. I would game my sisters and I would say like, oh, these two shitty candies are as great as your big full size Hershey.
No, I would never think to do that. And also, my siblings are too smart to fall for something like that.
My sisters did not
just disappear them.
I know my sister is
I would
like,
be like,
know.
Your candy is just getting less and less. It's so weird.
It's so weird. My sisters love me. They would do anything for me, which is why I was able to do.
Aww.
That.
That's so nice. Is there quite an age difference between?
There's
you
five
guys?
And seven. Yeah.
Oh wow. So no wonder mine's just two and a half.
Yeah.
So they're
closer in age.
In our stock exchange, Tootsie Roll Pops. They had a high value.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. That's only in your house then.
Especially the blue ones.
The fruity ones are better than the chocolate ones, for sure.
Oh, I could never quite understand what a Tootsie Pop was going for. I was like, you have chewy chocolate inside.
It's not really chocolate.
It's not chocolate.
It's like malt.
It's more...
What is a Tootsie Roll?
Sugar.
A Tootsie Roll is something you chew while someone... describes chocolate far away.
And on that note, let's take a break.
Hey everyone, I'm Ahmed El Yakbar and I host See Something, Say Something, a podcast on American Muslims. We've recently come back from a hiatus and we want you all to join us or rejoin us. We're now crowdfunded on Patreon and we discuss everything. We analyze Muslims in media, politics, and culture. Like, honestly, we thought the Aladdin movie was surprisingly good. I was surprised too. Listen in to see why, and you can find us wherever you find your podcast at See Something, Say Something.
And we're back. It's time for Creeping Sharia.
Creeping Sharia. Guitars.
Did you guys enjoy that? I had fun.
Yeah. This is Zara's new project as a music writer.
Oh my God, I'm so excited.
My Creeping Sharia is really quick. It's this kimono-inspired hijab.
What?
That's happening in Kyoto. I guess Kyoto has a lot of tourists and they have a lot of Muslim tourists. And so they wanted to create a hijab for the tourists that were coming through. So they created actually very gorgeous hijabs.
I'm looking at them now. These are beautiful.
They're beautiful. So it's taking the traditional Japanese flower and art and turning it into a scarf pattern.
Those are beautiful.
I feel like this is a pretty solid creep, a creep into Kyoto.
So wait, but then now if woman in the suburbs wears one, is it an appropriation?
Well, there's already a significant population of Muslims in East Asia who I'm assuming these scarves are the main clientele for. And I think the prints and the motifs, like when they say kimono inspired, it's not a kimono, it's a scarf. It's a scarf around the head. And I think there are a lot of like floral print scarves. And these just take floral prints that are more typically found on a kimono. And since it's a Japanese woman making them, I mean, appropriation implies a direction of power that is harmful to promote.
Mm.
I think a Japanese woman making a Japanese style headscarf.
And she's making them for the tourist area and mm-hmm. souvenir shops. So
if I buy these for my Persian aunties for Christmas,
yeah.
Good.
I think they might love it. I'd love one. I wonder if they are available online. Yeah.
This might just be a good reason to go to Kyoto, though.
As if I needed another one.
Yeah. I think. I'm sorry, what's your creep?
My Creeping Sharia, I'm really excited about.
I found it's so silly.
Persian trap music.
I feel like this is also, like, you've been, like, wanting this so hard for, like, the 5 years we've had this podcast. It's kind of momentous to get to this point of the show.
I finally got here.
Yeah. How'd you find this musician?
One of my cousins, Aydin. What's up? He sent it to me on Instagram. He was like, yo. And I was like, shut up.
Now, was it an ironic share? Is he a fan? Is this?
No, he's a fan.
Okay, cool. I'm excited to listen.
This guy's rad.
Should we play something?
Yeah, I'll play something.
So when he said trap, he meant like electronic trap, not like rap trap music.
Apparently. I
don't know the difference.
First, I want to say the scarf he's wearing was just kind of funny. Second, the way he threw the tambourine, that was amazing.
Loved it. Fantastic flair. The melody was very early aughts rap rock to me. Like, I could definitely see Linkin Park having a Eastern-inspired moment with that dun 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 dun. Like,
Zara's giving you a look of confusion.
No, I'm absorbing learning.
Oh.
I'm learning. This is information I'm taking in. I know nothing about music.
You've shared some very special music with us today.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I want to hear more about it. What do you guys think?
When you said trap music, I thought it might be rap. And it's interesting because how that genre has influenced all kinds of rap music that all sounds the same, except it's in different languages. So there's Australian trap and Egyptian trap and Moroccan trap. And it's great. It's like both drill inspired and grime inspired. But everyone, like, when they post it to YouTube, is calling it trap.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Like, it's like,
yeah, I kind of feel like trap is kind of taking in all, because isn't traps just supposed to be like a.
If this is helpful, here's some that's more rappy. Okay, so now what do you guys think?
I'm happy you found a genre of music that you like, Zara.
You're not into it?
I don't think I am into this. Yeah.
Aisha's into it.
Aisha's into
it. Yeah. Me, you, candy corn, and this.
Oh, Halloween, baby. Here we come.
I think it is interesting that the artists that you're sending over are Los Angeles based. I thought that was cool. Because I think that kind of like speaks to like, you know, like I'm fascinated by diaspora music and just like how the diaspora is able to like take traditional music and intertwine it with more modern stuff. I think most of what I actually do hear coming out of Iran is the Iran punk scene. And then it's like, also, if it's in LA, how come we haven't been to their show yet, Zara?
I do and don't want to meet them.
I know. They look kind of fuckboyish.
Yeah, but that's kind of hot.
Zara.
But I do and don't want to meet him. I don't have a great record with Persian men.
Yeah.
Let's get into that. That's interesting.
Not really. Not really. If you're a Persian man out there, I am talking about you. All right. What's your creeping Sharia, Aisha?
Mine is quite a bummer of a story, actually. Unfortunately, I feel like it's not the best example of Muslim influence as it is of the hostility towards Muslims. So A 16-year-old named Noor was at a track meet, and it was her personal best time. And when she went to see the final results, her name and time weren't listed. And it was only after asking why that she was told her hijab, which was a Nike brand runner's hijab.
Bullshit.
She was told that that violated the uniform policy. And that was the reason she'd been disqualified. And even though it was her personal best time, it wasn't even considered towards the race.
Why didn't they stop her before the race even started?
That was her question as well, because Each runner's uniform is reviewed before the beginning of the race.
Yeah.
For example, one of her teammates, her shorts were deemed not up to code. And so she had the opportunity to change before the race.
Mm-mm.
Now, you'd think that her hijab, which she's competed in before, would have been, not only should it have been allowed, but as she mentions in the article we're referencing, which is available on Huffington Post, reported by Rueda Abdulaziz, you know, she mentions that she wasn't even told until after she competed in the race, and that her coach already knew. And
why didn't the coach say anything?
Imagining how hurt and disrespected she must have felt.
That's weird.
That's shady. That's like disrespectful.
I almost don't believe it. But
yeah, exactly.
Also, this is Nike.
Yeah.
Like
the brand of the scarf
let's
that
hit
she's
up
wearing,
Nike and be like, hey, how come your stuff's not up to code? Why
no,
should
it is up to code.
It?
I think they
exactly.
just said
right.
that
it was designed for runners. It's not even like a scarf. It's like a stretchy head covering that
Bullshit.
Goes into your shirt. And the article mentions that the International Boxing Association announced earlier this year that Muslim women are allowed to compete in the hijab, and many athletic organizations and various tournaments and various sports. This is something they've unfortunately had to confront with because of the prevalence of anti-Muslim bias.
Yeah.
And a bias that Muslim female athletes experience disproportionately, because often they've made the choice to wear a hijab and cover their hair as they compete, the way they cover their hair, you know, in other arenas of their life. And any bans on that type of head covering is a statement against Muslim women and how welcome they might feel. And it goes beyond feeling welcome or unwelcome.
Yeah, it's
about it's about making a spectacle of them and saying that there's no place for you here.
Mm-hmm. Poor girl, 16 years old. I can't imagine going through that experience at 16.
I think more power to her. I think she's been very brave to speak about this. I hope her teammates show her the support and solidarity she deserves.
So
I'm disappointed in her coach for not standing up for her as, you know, an adult in charge of that situation. You know, it's a shame they talk about Muslim women and the oppression they face, and they being like Western, often white non-Muslims, want to tell us about the obstacles Muslim women face when these, so often they're the ones generating these obstacles.
Yeah, this is just in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
So who do we write to?
Sylvania Northview High School.
There it is.
And Sylvania has a pretty significant Muslim population. The mosque nearby in Toledo has been attacked many times.
Wow.
It's a mosque my family attended for many years. And it's dismaying to see that anti-Muslim bias is still so prevalent in the day-to-day lives of the Muslims living there. More power to Noor and
More
any other athlete.
More power to Noor. Moving on to Awkward Ask a Muslim.
Awkward. Okay, what you got, Zara?
All right. This was so awkward.
What happened?
I was on the plane and the guy next to me, we were in like a 3-hour delay.
Ugh. You were on a plane for a 3-hour delay? Like,
we were on the runway.
Oh, I hate those.
It's the worst.
Those are the worst.
I was coming back from Kentucky. There's a 3-hour delay. We're sitting on the runway. We're stuck. And this is that stopover in Dallas. I feel like everybody gets stuck in Dallas.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the worst.
This dude next to me, I didn't know was drunk already.
Oh, no.
But he was, like, sounding normal drunk, which is even more concerning. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, he just seemed
like
friendly.
Like, they've done it before.
Yeah, a lot. Like, every day.
Multiple times.
Every day. And then he started telling me about his job.
Oh, no, a talkative drunk.
This is beyond talkative. So, his job was, like, it's based off what he described, was to be the muscle that beats people up, like, as a contractor.
What?
And he's, like, flown all over the country.
Wait, he flies around the country and beats people up?
He's the muscle.
What do you mean the muscle?
I don't know what it means.
Like, hired security? Is he going to come after us?
It's a dream job. You know, yeah, I find it so unfair that I don't get approached for opportunities like that when I've expressed at numerous points how well-suited I would be to that role.
Aisha's ready.
So then what happened?
Well, I just kept trying to, like, make the conversation not about things that I would need to react to like that.
Yeah.
Because it was going to be a long-ass flight.
Oh.
So I was like,
going to go to sleep now. Good night.
Gosh, that's the worst.
Oh, my God.
When it's a flight, because you don't really have the option to escape that situation.
No, and then on top of that, he was like, oh, I'm being that talkative drunk guy. And then you have to be like,
so he was
no.
putting the burden on you to make him comfortable
exactly.
and give him permission to continue talking
like,
to you.
Permission
yes, you
to continue talking. Yep. And then when he would leave, the lady next to him just goes, leans in and she goes, oh, my God, what a chatty Kathy. Sorry, I'm that drunk mom on the flight. Ah! Like that.
Goodness.
And I was like, where am I?
Bad like flight seatmates are this, I think, are equivalent to an aggressively creepy Uber driver.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And we all
yeah,
have stories of that.
Yeah.
That's commonplace. Less common, fortunately, though we could stand for it to be even rarer, is a Nazi Uber driver, which is what I experienced recently in Seattle.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. What happened?
Luckily, it was a very brief trip, which is why it was all the more absurdly comic almost, because at any time it could have gotten violent. But racism is inherently absurd, but it was even more, like, ridiculous, given the fact that you accept a ride from someone with a clearly non-white name,
yeah.
like mine. It's a white dude. And often, you know, white Uber drivers are very different from people of color who are Uber drivers. Their expectations of their passengers, their attitude to the role.
Mm-hmm.
You'll notice that they're just more respectful and silent if they're an Uber driver of color, in my experience. And they don't really impose on you the same way that a white guy will.
I also think the city matters, too, because I think
the city does matter.
Yeah.
But I think in my experience, which has largely been in L.A., white guys are a little less reluctant to mm-hmm. perform the role of your driver and carry on as if they're your friend giving you a ride, which is a very interesting, I think, attitude towards service labor from white men. That aside, this is in Seattle, the Pacific Northwest, while having a tradition of progressivism, also has a tradition of deep-seated organized racism
mm-hmm.
and white supremacists. This is a young man, young as in probably in his late 20s. And first of all, you're in a Prius, so relax. Second of all, you're wearing driving gloves.
He has driving gloves.
In a Prius.
Why? That's
He's
creepy.
Serious about it, you know?
Murder gloves.
Is very loudly discussing on his phone his weed growing operation with his buddy, who I'm assuming
of
shares
course.
His politics.
That's why you wear driving gloves.
And I mean, it's just loud and aggressive and turns to us. I was with one other person, luckily,
thank God.
Who was a guy. But here's where it gets more complicated, because, of course, that's who he chooses to get aggressive with and carries on as if he's about to pull over and fight with us.
Whoa.
And the situation escalated. Just as he ends his call and he turns to us and goes, are you Pakistani or Indian? Which, first of all, I'm impressed by your familiarity. Most white people don't really know what region of the world to ascribe your non-whiteness to. And right off the bat, he's like, let's go.
Damn.
Before we can answer, which we're not really that moved to answer.
Yeah.
So we, you know, while confined to the back of the car that he is in control of, just respond, you know, we're from the state. And knowing the conversation isn't going to go anywhere we'd like, but counting on how short the ride is to make things easier for us. And he responds with, I'm of strong Aryan stock.
Whoa.
I'm from good Irish-German background. What do you know about that? And just, you know, again, launches into a powerful, I guess in his eyes, monologue about his strong Irish-German stock.
Oh my gosh.
And again, you're wearing driving gloves in a Prius. Fingerless leather driving gloves.
Fingerless.
That's not good
That's not useful. Yeah. You need the
It's a look. It's certainly a choice.
Madonna wore fingerless gloves. Okay, my speaking of clothing, my awkward ask. So I do this thing with women of my size, which feels silly to say. I do clothing swaps, and they're only useful if you have women who are the same size clothes as you.
Yay.
Because what you do is you get all your clothes, and you kind of like dump it in a room, and then you pick through them.
I love clothing swaps.
I love clothing swaps. They're really not fun if you're not all the same size, because then you're just
looking
at your clothes.
That's such a sweet idea, especially if you have stylish friends, and it's so environmentally economical.
Yeah, and instead of donating to Goodwill, you're donating to your friends. And this way, you're also more likely to pull out the really expensive dress that you can't fit into anymore, that you just can't give to Goodwill, but you know if you give it to this friend, you'll feel better about it.
Okay, so what's the awkward part?
The awkward part is I have a lot of Daisy clothes that I don't fit into anymore. And I have a sari top. The sari top is kind of a crop top that kind of buttons in the front. And I had non-Daisy friends in the room that wanted to wear it just kind of as a shirt.
Uh-oh.
I was just like, oh, I just didn't know what to do in that situation. Like, it's appropriation, but it's also recycling. And it's my friends, and they're getting it from me, but would it be appropriation? So I just didn't know what to do in that situation.
Awkward.
It was very awkward.
I love the title of the segment because awkward ask a Muslim. So often what is awkward is people asking you if you're Muslim. Like, that's never going to go anywhere great. I think 99.9% of the time if I've been asked, are you Muslim? The response to my answer is as if I've just admitted to a terminal illness. Like, they'll immediately just start whispering for no reason. Like, oh, I'm okay. And that's if they're a well-meaning person. They don't know how to react to that.
I don't actually get, are you Muslim anymore?
If Mahershala Ali asked me,
what would you say?
Yeah.
I think because we have this podcast called Good Muslim, Bad Muslim.
People
like,
know off
people
off the
kind
bat.
Of know that we
and
are
it just depends
at this
on
point.
Who's asking. If a Muslim's asking you, then they're going to say that question quite differently.
I would answer it like that too. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I think I get more like the how Muslim are you or like are you a practicing Muslim? Those are the
who's the bad one?
Yeah, how good of a Muslim are you? So those are actually probably why we started this
That's
segment.
That's for God to decide.
Exactly.
That's what you have to tell people, but then they're like, no, I want to decide.
It's like, I'll let you know as soon as God gets back to me.
Mm-hmm. I'm using that one. It's fatwa time.
It's fatwa time. Okay, my fatwa is books that have veils on the cover, which apparently is a thing. I follow at Ms. Entropy on Twitter.
Okay, hold on. I'm going to look this up.
And Ms. Entropy was very upset
These are ridiculous.
By how veils were being used in books. So she started this epic thread of all these books that use variations of unveiled or behind the veil.
Persia, unveiling. I mean, it's such a cliche.
It's so cliched.
Epidemic. And it's been for decades now.
Wait, let's read some of these. Persia unveiled.
Veils of Yemen.
Behind the veils of Yemen. I mean, a significant portion of these are just behind the veil, lifting the veil.
Islam unveiled. Volume
Beyond
one unveiled.
Veil. Veiled threats.
Lifting the veil.
The Scimitar and the Veil.
Volume 1 unveiled.
Unveiling Islam. Also, like, okay, here's
you
the
would,
thing.
You would, think, you, would think, you would think it would have been unveiled by now, given how much unveiling has been going on.
Also, don't people just Google before they come up with titles of books? Like, I feel like just Google this shit.
Unveiling the Veils of Veils to Come.
Wait, was that on there?
No. I love that you can't tell.
I thought that's what it was.
Well, I mean, it goes back to what we were talking about with that runner getting disqualified and how this preoccupation with what's perceived as like the veiled nature. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we could go in deep on the colonial and orientalist view towards Muslims that this is all generated out of. But yes. Edward Said already said it better in Orientalism. Like, this is still so endemic because there is a resentment towards what's perceived to be hidden from the colonizer's view. And there's also this claim of authority over Islam that so many of these authors who are white Western authors, they take it upon themselves to pretend they're revealing something hidden.
Yep. Can we have that be the definition of tired?
Tired.
This is tired. Like, it'll include colonialism.
I think what Aisha's speaking to is like almost all of the titles or all the authors of the books that are being shown in this thread are white names. And almost all of the images are of women in niqab.
And not their whole face, just like the presence of a woman is invoked. But again, she's anonymous.
Yeah.
And most of these books are supposedly like works of nonfiction on specific countries. Mm-hmm. But the motif repeated, whether it's this book on Afghanistan or the one on Yemen, is that of a covered woman. And so the woman and the state become conflated and both are being fantasized about as a place of mystery that the West can then not only reveal, but then violate through invasion.
Though I feel like this one that we're looking at isn't Islam related. This is veiled threats, but it's just a white woman in a wedding gown with a... you know, veil, because veils are both.
That's quite funny. I like that. I like this being used in the context of
right?
a murderous bride.
Right?
Veiled
exactly.
threats. Oh, yeah. I love that.
I love it. So that's my fatwa. Get better with book covers.
I fatwa giving out raisins on Halloween.
What?
It's fucked up.
It's healthy.
No, it's not actually.
What about chocolate covered raisins?
No, it's not healthy. It's a lot of sugar. It's a lot of sugar and it's really bad for your teeth.
Chocolate covered ones.
I mean, you know, anything with chocolate on it is fine for Halloween.
Okay.
Yeah. Give me chocolate covered human fingers. I'll have them.
The first time. Ooh.
Yeah.
The first time I learned about chocolate covered raisins, I was like, what? You can take fruits and cover them in chocolate. I was really impressed that this was a thing. I was like, this is healthy food covered in chocolate?
Raisins? Don't give out raisins. Like, I can't even believe I need to say that to people.
I mean, I can't actually remember the last time I ate a raisin.
Like, stop giving out raisins during Halloween and end white supremacy. Like, the two, just stop it.
Yeah. So you heard of any kind of other fruits?
On Halloween? I think if anyone handed me a fruit, I would run the other way.
So you knew which houses to avoid?
Yeah. Well, we had like where I grew up was like super affluent.
Yeah.
High school town. So we had like the king size bars.
What?
Yeah.
When Costco. You went to the doors?
Yeah. And there was this like famous house called the Applegates.
Oh.
And apparently, I don't even know if this is true, but the story was that like they had a contract that they gave to the people who bought the house after them.
What?
That on Halloween they had to give out king size M&Ms.
Oh my gosh.
That was the requirement of anyone who bought the house. So like everyone went there.
I mean, what kind of contract is this? Like,
I have no idea. Like, but there was like always these like courts that you would know gave out king size candy from Costco.
I knew only which house would give out pixie sticks. That was the house I would go to.
Man, those give me such a headache. Okay, I do want to hear Aisha's pomegranate story though.
Oh, I don't have much of a story. I just really love pomegranates. I think they're a versatile and delicious fruit that have such a strong flavor profile that they're an underrated ingredient. And I don't just mean tossed into salads, but you can make really delicious sauces out of them. And I just had a really delicious pomegranate this morning and I would like to have more.
As a Persian,
yeah.
I totally dig this positive fatwa for more pomegranates in your life.
I mean, what Persian cuisine has done with pomegranates mm-hmm. is inspiring.
Oh yeah, we kicked it up a notch, yeah.
Absolutely. I think they really respect it as an ingredient and know how to use it.
Oh, do I drop truth now about
yes,
pomegranates?
Please do. Yeah. Let's talk about our different ways of peeling a pomegranate.
Okay. I don't peel it.
Okay.
You take a pomegranate, mm-hmm. you roll it on a countertop the way people do a lemon.
Or a mango.
Right. You crush it a little bit, right? You bite into the rind and then you suck on for dear life. You squeeze it, you crush it, and that's how you get fresh pomegranate juice. You don't eat a single seed.
Okay. The way I do it is I will have a bowl of water. Mm. I'll score the pomegranate, mm-hmm. and then I'll submerge it, and then I'll peel it underwater. Mm-hmm. So then all the white gross parts, they float to the top, and the seeds fall to the bottom. And then you sieve it.
Oh, that I like that technique, Taz. That's...
Then you don't spill pomegranate juice all over the place.
Right. I found I always end up with, like, little flecks of pomegranate juice mm-hmm. after dismembering a pomegranate. Yeah.
My family was upset.
It leaves both my clothes and whatever countertop I'm using yeah. as, you know, a little bit like a very whimsical crime scene.
I will send you a YouTube video.
I've seen them and I'm very inspired by the ones that just know where to score them. So
that I tried that.
The segments are even. It doesn't work because every pomegranate is different, you know? I think
you just squeeze and crush and suck.
I like to have a bowl full of the arils and just scoop them into my mouth because I like the opportunity to eat a lot of something.
Yeah.
Okay, but are we all three in agreement that the people who suck and then spit out the seeds are weird as
doing
fuck?
Too much?
That's, no.
Yeah, no.
Eat the weird. Seeds. The seeds are good for your digestive system.
It's worth the effort, I think. Mm-hmm. And you can sprinkle a little salt and pepper or some sugar.
Salt is so good on pomegranate seeds.
It really is. Mm-hmm.
It's delish. Well, it's time for Good Muslim Awards.
Mashallah! 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 You're fantastic and amazing! Good Muslim Award!
My Good Muslim Award is going to two artists that I had a chance to check out this month. One is the photographer Hassan Hajjaj. He had a rock experience with all these amazing Muslimish musicians at the Ford Amphitheater. His photos are amazing. It's a dream of mine to get photographed by him. And the other one is also a photographer, Shireen Nashat, who is a Persian from Berkeley photographer who has a exhibit up over at the Broad. And I don't know, it was just the Ford Amphitheater and the Broad in Los Angeles are such elite spaces of art that it was just amazing to be there and see Muslim folks and Muslimish folks and brown folks kind of like take over the space with their artistic expression that was very not white. I loved it and I'm very inspired by seeing both of them.
Does Hassan Hajjaj have an exhibit up currently?
He does not, but he's doing these rock, I think he's calling it rock experience. Hassan Hajjaj is having these rock experiences happening where he's featuring musicians, and the musicians are styled by him in his unique eye, and they kind of like perform, and it was amazing. Omar Effendim was one of the artists that I got to see perform. He's a friend and just awesome, awesome performer. So that's my award.
That's a good one. All right, I got one. My Good Muslim Award goes to Eri Susanti Rahayu, the record breaker in women's climbing that they're now calling Spider Women. Have you seen her?
I saw the video. And I also saw that you were trying to climb walls too.
Yo, I have such an appreciation for how fast she climbed that wall.
So was it okay? So when you're in Kentucky,
this is free climbing.
You tried rock climbing.
My friends Andrew and Lauren took me rock climbing. Yeah. They're my new best friends.
Okay.
Thank you so much. They took me to Club Nulu in Louisville, Kentucky. Yeah. And I got a free one-on-one
amazing.
From two people on how to fall and how to climb.
And it looked really easy.
It's so hard.
Really?
You have to learn how to use oppositional force.
Oh my gosh.
So you're,
oh, right.
Yeah, you're pushing with one arm and like pushing with the other to thrust your body upward. And I had to use my whole, you know, choreograph my whole body to like lift myself up. And then I also got a special training as a woman climbing from Lauren because women have to use our bodies differently mm-hmm. to climb than men do.
So now that you've had this experience, what do you see when you see the Spider Woman climbing the wall?
A fucking badass.
Yeah. She went so fast.
So fast.
Yeah.
Like a gecko. Just boom, 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 boom.
Yeah.
Right to the top. It was amazing.
Yeah.
And it was just like so pro. She just has such a like trust in her body. It's like no question. You know what I mean? I'm going to the top. Done. It's fantastic. Watch it over and over again. It's great.
It's very inspiring, especially because you see her in comparison to the woman she was competing with.
Yeah.
And that really gives you a sense of just how
fast
Aries is going.
So fast.
Also, what a great name, Aries.
Aries.
I wonder if that's how it's pronounced. What if it's Aries?
Hmm.
Either way, we stan.
What's yours?
I would like to give a Good Muslim Award to my friend that I lived with in London, my roommate who recently visited me in LA and I think is an exemplary Muslim and a really great friend.
Oh, do we get their name?
Yes. Shout out to Halima, and I hope you had a nice time in LA. And it's just really nice to, you know, I never had a roommate before. I think when we all live so far apart from each other, we being like immigrants, Pakistanis, Muslims, I think the opportunity to forge close ties with someone who's also Muslim was an experience I really treasured and and value, because so few of the spaces I'm in offer that to me, or, you know, have an opportunity for that available. And I don't take it lightly, and it just feels good to be with your people. Likewise, this podcast is a lot of fun. Thank you guys so much for having me.
Thanks for being
here. For joining us.
Yeah, I feel like that about our podcast. It's been 5 years of being Muslim feminist
together.
And together,
yeah,
on the airwaves.
Well, I think to be a Muslim by yourself is, I think, not a full fulfillment of the tenets of our faith. Mm-hmm. We're called to be in community with each other.
Yes.
And I think it's important to make the effort to do that, because it's very easy to not do that, you know? And I think I do gain a lot from being reminded of my common ties, and to just the relief that comes with being in a place where you can assume shared values.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's something that's very rare. And I know it has been rare growing up for me. So there's a special premium on it for me now as an adult deciding the kind of life I want to live day to day.
I feel like that's a beautiful note to end the show on.
It is. And happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween,
everyone.
Zara, what do you have going on?
Oh my God, I am so excited to announce that I'll be in another season of United Shades of America with W. Kamau Bell on CNN. Look for me this spring season. And my pop culture collaborative report on comedy is out. Check it out. And I've got a new podcast that I'm getting going called Don't Stop Believing. I'm starting to dig my title.
Yeah, it's a good...
That sounds great. That sounds
familiar.
And November 2nd, if you're around, I'll be giving a TEDx on comedy in Sonoma, and you can check it out online when it comes out. Taz, what you got going on?
I have a very busy November, going to lots of retreats, but the one public thing I'm doing is, if you are around Los Angeles November 1st, I'm going to be interviewing Jeff Chang at Power to the People, which is an anniversary event for the UCLA Asian American Studies. It's going to be in Little Tokyo. Tickets are still available. I'm interviewing him for a new podcast I'm working on with my day job, 18 Million Rising. So we'll be recording that, and that will be available at an upcoming date. I don't know if I want to share the name of the podcast yet, because I think we're going to change the title. But right now, we're calling it The Subaltern Speaks.
Ooh.
But we realize that it's a very nerdy title, so we might change it. It's not appealing to the base that we're trying to appeal to, so we might change the title. But basically, it's going to be an Asian American advice column podcast, and we're very excited. So both Zara's podcast and my podcast, you'll be able to hear on this RSS feed, because we'll be sharing it out once they're out.
Yay!
Aisha.
People can find me online at Aisha A. Siddiqui. They can find my collaboration with Cult Days and other original designs at theoneswelove.shop. And thank you guys so much. This is a lot of fun.
Thanks for being a guest on our podcast.
And look for tickets for our live show. Stay tuned.
Thanks for listening to the Good Muslim, Bad Muslim podcast, hosted by Taz Ahmed and Zara Nourmash. You can follow Taz on Twitter at TazzyStar. That's TAZZYSTAR. And Zara at Zara Comedy. That's ZAHRA Comedy. The show is produced and edited by Quincy Sarasmith, and you can find us on the web at goodmuslimbadmuslim.com. To follow the conversation, please use the hashtag GoodMuslimBadMuslim.
Persian trap music brought to you by Behzad Lito in Palang, and music interstitials brought to you by Scott Okamoto.
Good Muslim, Bad Muslim is recorded at the Potluck Podcast Studio, located at Visual Communications. Visual Communications develops and supports the voices of Asian American and Pacific Islander media artists who empower communities and challenge perspectives. Some of their annual programs include the Academy Award qualifying Los Angeles Asian Pacific Film Festival, the Armed with a Camera Fellowship, and C3, the Conference for Creative Content. Learn more at bconline.org. Good Muslim, Bad Muslim is a proud member of Potluck, a collective that features stories and voices from the Asian American community.
Holy
Potluck.
Potluck.
But we're still here. And
And we're going strong.
It's an exciting time in Asian America. There are more movies, TV shows, books, and music reflecting us than ever. But all of these represent just a small slice of Asian American culture and experiences. So what do? Tell more slices. Asian Americana is a show that explores these slices of distinctly Asian American culture and history. We've talked about how Chinese Americans built California's Sacramento Delta, the art scene turned gallery institution Giant Robot, a play that explores the lost Cambodian pop music of the 60s and 70s, and, of course, Boba, just to name a few stories. You can find Asian Americana at asianamericana.com or on your podcast app. And we're getting tired of proving
we belong. What do you mean the muscle?
I don't know what it means.
Like hired security? Is he going to come after us?
It's a dream job.